Welcome to episode number 5 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, and leadership, and what it takes to have a wellness culture within your organization. Hi, my name is Conrad Weaver, and while I'm not a first responder, I've worked with first responders from all across the country for my documentary film, PTSD 911. My guest today is Dr. Anna Fitch Corey. Dr. Corey is the Director of Responder Wellness with the FirstNet program at AT&T. She's a nurse, an Army wife, a former university faculty, and author. Dr. Corey has worked for more than 20 years in the healthcare profession, including bone marrow transplant, intensive care, public health, and health promotion practice. She holds a bachelor's degree in nursing from Clemson University, a master's in nursing education from the University of Wyoming, and a doctor of nursing practice from The Ohio State University. Dr. Corey's area of expertise is integration of public health strategy across disparate organizations to achieve health improvement goals. In our conversation today, we talk about what it takes to develop a wellness culture within public safety agencies. And Dr. Corey shares her perspectives on how this is happening across the country. Hey, a quick sidebar. I really appreciate you listening to this podcast. And if you think others would too, please subscribe and share. And if you'd like to watch the video of this interview, check out our Patreon page where you'll be able to get the audio and video a day early. Plus, you'll be able to see all of the episodes on video. It's the only place you'll be able to watch the interviews of this podcast, so check it out. Plus, we'll offer other amazing content not available anywhere else. Our Patreon members help support this channel and allow us to continue to bring high-quality podcast content to you absolutely free. Thank you for supporting the show. And now, here's my interview with Dr. Anna Fitch Corey. Dr. Corey, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Thank you so much for being here today.
I am delighted and really excited about the conversation that we're going to have.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about, first of all, for the audience, who are you and what do you do?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm Dr. Anna Fitch Corey. I am the director for First Responder Health and Wellness at the FirstNet program at AT&T, where I lead a portfolio of different efforts to drive programs, policy, governance, advocacy in the field of public safety wellness.
Yeah. So how long have you been doing that?
We stood up the program in May of 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic, because we weren't afraid to keep working, just like our first responders, to support them. And now we're going into almost 3 years strong and have had tremendous results from the collaboration, the enthusiasm, and really the sustained effort across all leaders in public safety to advance this issue. So I'm deeply grateful to be joined at the table by the different national public safety associations who recognize that their first responders and emergency responders need caring for. They recognize the problem.
Now, you have a nursing background, but how did you get involved with first responders?
Right. Yeah. So happen? I started out. That's a great question. I started out in ICU, bone marrow transplant, ER rotation. So saw the other end of response, right? When the victims came to the healthcare system for assistance and support where they were in their health journey. And love that. I always laugh because when I think about, 20-year-old Anna, she wanted to be a critical care nurse and professor and thought that that was really where my career would go over the last, 25, almost 30 years of the work that I've been doing. But I married a soldier. My soldier took me overseas to Germany at the beginning of the global war on terrorism and the 1st Infantry Division, where I started working in public health and specifically in community health improvement planning. Now, what does that have to do with first responders, right? So there are distinct similarities between the active duty military population and first responders. Number one, they're both operational professions. That means they are generally professions who run towards a problem. They are professions that use their body to solve those problems, right? There's a distinct physical toil as well as mental and spiritual toil in the work that they do. And they ensure our nation's and community infrastructure and safety. So I have been working with operational professions for the last 20 years. I went on from working with the 1st Infantry Division to working for U.S. Army Public Health Center, which stood up the Army's Community Health Promotion Council process. It's actually now called the Commanders Ready and Resilient Council. But what that is a strategic planning process for the soldiers, civilians, and family members of the United States Army. And as I pursued that academic dream that I had had from when I was a young nurse and started going into becoming, I'm a board certified public health nurse. My expertise is in strategic planning for these professions that work in this space. And I met what I did not know at the time was the leadership of FirstNet. He was a West Point graduate, and we were discussing the problems facing the United States Army with their health and wellness. And again, those similarities between the first responder population. In fact, if your listeners are not aware, almost 40% of first responders have some sort of military experience. So they're coming into the profession a lot of times with some of those health risk factors that face our active duty population. FirstNet was very concerned about the problems facing public safety and wanted to do something about it and invited me to build out that program for them. So that's what brought me into very specifically the public safety space. But I have a very long history of working in those operational professions.
Mm-hmm. It's just interesting that here's what we think of a phone company, you know, is in the public safety space and in wellness.
Right.
Because I guess you guys connect obviously with your customers, but then also you work directly with agencies and first responder agencies, right?
Well, and I think that's one of the things that makes AT&T a little bit different. And generally, when I go speak about health and wellness, I really do just direct, what does a telephone company have to do with health and wellness? It is a bit of an elephant in the room, right, if you will. But if you think about the long history of AT&T, they were the ones that helped start 911. Way back when, right? Mm-hmm. I can't quote the exact dates off the top of my head, but they were a huge supporter of establishing that infrastructure for emergency communications. They have had a long-standing support of connecting individuals in their most desperate times. Mm-hmm. They have a robust disaster response plan. And I think when they were awarded the contract to build out FirstNet, and what many people don't know is that FirstNet was born out of the devastation of 9/11. The number one loss of life was failures in communications to connect people to the help that they need because there was competition on the bandwidth. And AT&T quickly realized how important it was that first responders have a network of their own. And so when Congress mandated the First Responder Network Authority and charged them with building out FirstNet, AT&T was awarded that contract in 2017 and has continued to work with public safety to build them their network. It was always understood just that nature of recognizing what our American communities need to survive and thrive in light of their connectivity. AT&T has always been a partner in that with our local level. And so it felt like a natural transition. And then when disaster strikes, we have a team of first responders from the Response Operations Group that deploy with our public safety partners in the local community, whether that's man-made or natural disasters, from shootings to the fire in Maui to wildfires on the West Coast, hurricanes, tornadoes, the floodings in Kentucky last year, and many more. Our response operations group has been there right along with it, as well as our network disaster recovery folks. So there are teams within the organization that deploy, and what they saw, the mental health and wellness effects on those public safety colleagues that they were working with. And, you know, in some of the situations, especially Maui, especially the floodings in Kentucky, some of those stressors were starting to affect our own individuals. Mm-hmm. You know, many people don't realize we have a team that embeds with FEMA. Mm-hmm. And what does FEMA do? Body recovery. That's intensive work. You know, you don't go to work for a telephone company thinking that you're going to be embedded with FEMA. And yet that sort of thing happens more often than you realize as a part of our work with FirstNet.
So do you guys have structures within the organization itself to take care of your own in situations like that?
Yes. So absolutely. There's a number of different things. Obviously, as a corporation, we have a robust employee benefits plan. Mm-hmm. That is one of the things that AT&T takes care of all of our people from a benefits perspective. But one of the things that started out this year that was new, that had not been done before within AT&T, is we stood up a peer support program. You know, it's one of those evidence-based programs that we recommend that public safety does themselves, because there's so much that shows having somebody who is a trained listener to connect following disaster, that is a peer that has been in that situation with them, really enhances the well-being of that individual and serves as a bridge between the critical incident and the resources that may be available. And it was a natural progression of my portfolio that we started looking not just out at our first responders that we support from a customer-centric perspective, but then start looking at ourselves and holding ourselves up to that same mirror, those same standards of wellness, and implementing similar programs for our own people that were going out there. It's been wildly successful. I think we've done over 1,500 hours of peer support to date since we started the program in January, and have just been so gratified as the lead for that program to have a team of they're volunteers throughout our business who support their colleagues when disaster strikes. So that's been a tremendous part of my portfolio that's grown out this past year.
I'm sure that has to be satisfying to know that not only can you teach this when you go to first responder conferences and other things like that, but you also can model that as a company, as an organization.
I hope so, because one of the things that we tell leaders in the public safety space, and I've talked to CEOs, executive directors, presidents, different leadership positions, and one of the things that I always tell them is people are watching you. If you're not modeling and demonstrating what you are saying is important to those that are behind you or following up, they're not going to take that on and then continue to seed that shift in the culture to one of wellness. So I tell the leaders many, many times, they're watching you. They want to see how you respond to stress. And are you willing to share those stories? Are you willing to share when it's been a bad day? Are you willing to share what you did when you hit rock bottom? Mm-hmm. And what did you do wrong? And what did you do right? And I think that if I can't model those same things in my own professional life, I would be hard pressed to, you know, go to public safety and say the same thing. So I really do hope that we are also leading in this space.
You know, and speaking with people across the country, you know, as I have, and I'm sure you have as well, you hear stories of people who say, well, you know what, we're just waiting for the chief to retire. It falls on the leadership to really take the momentum of this and take the lead in wellness for their fire company, for their police department, for their 911 call center. If the leader isn't in that space, what do you do?
So that's where you really work on a groundswell momentum of grassroots work. The more people you have talking about the issue, the problems facing that agency, the more that the responders as individuals start advocating for what they need to be successful. I mean, responders go into this job because they love it, right? Sure. They see purpose, they see passion. And it's not that their lack of wanting to do this job that is burning them out. It's a lack of being heard and lack of being recognized if they're not being given the resources that they need to be successful. And so I think that when you have that groundswell of voices that are coming together, then that's what can start changing the leadership, and they start paying attention to what's being said at the local level. We've seen this on a similar basis with the FirstNet Health and Wellness Coalition. Before FirstNet started this essentially one of its kind collaborative public-private partnership, we brought together 28 National Public Safety Association C-level executives across all those professions. From the moment that call is made all the way until the victims may arrive in the healthcare system, corrections, emergency management, 911 telecommunications, and our traditional EMS, fire, and police. Their leaders are coming to the table. And the one thing that they have said consistently over the last 3 years is we are now seeing the problems that we all share and how what a strong voice it is when we come together. And I would say that that same model of that strong, unified voice can help shift the momentum when you need to get wellness building in an agency where the leadership may be a little bit skeptical at first.
Mm-hmm. Where does the responsibility lie for the individual as well? If the agency doesn't have a wellness program, or if they're not really into this wellness thing, they're like, oh, you know, just suck it up. What's the responsibility for the individual to say, hey, I need to take care of myself first?
Well, I'm sure you and I have talked many times before. You've read my work. I believe very, very strongly in self-efficacy and self-agency, right? Mm-hmm. Every single person on the planet has a choice to make. You know, before you, when Viktor Frankl says, when between stimulus and response is a space, and in that space is a freedom to make a choice. And in that space, I mean, that freedom is your individual right to decide what is best for you as an individual to make the best choice. I'm not talking about making negative choices in that space, because a lot of times humans have a tendency to have a negative stimulus or a traumatic event, and we tend to think coping is drinking, alcohol, staying up late, numbing mechanisms, avoidance mechanisms. But that discounts those other choices you have in that space to take care of yourself, to seek help, to stand up for what is right. And it takes more and more of those individuals standing up for what is right to take control, so that, yes, it is absolutely an individual role, not just an agency role, to address health and wellness. Nobody can make anybody do anything, right? You can't make me go work out in the morning. You can't make me choose a salad versus French fries. You know, the only person that can start making that one step forward in my health and wellness decisions is me. And nobody can take those choices away from the individual.
And does it come down to kind of casting a vision? If you're a leader and you're casting this vision for this is who we are, we take care of ourselves, and we have peer support, we have all these other resources around us. It comes down to casting that vision. It's kind of like I saw an interview with Kobe Bryant when he was still alive, and he talked about, you know, joining some basketball team. I think it was LA Lakers, or I forget exactly who he played for, but he joined this team and they were going to, you know, he was like, I'm going to be at the gym at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Because that's what winners do. Mm-hmm. Winners get up early and they get out and work out. And the other guys are like, come on, we want to party, you know, tonight. He said, no, we're going to get up. If you want to win a championship, you gotta get up and do the hard thing. Yes. And it's part of that vision casting, I think, for leaders in the first responder space is to say, hey, if we want to thrive and prosper and have a long career, then we have to do the hard thing and do these things to enable us to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And hard things is what makes us uncomfortable, but hard things are also what makes us grow, right? Yeah. I think a part of the conversation in the public safety space is, yes, it is a hard job. It is a tough job. We talked about body recovery earlier. We're talking, you know, burned individuals in Miami. Those was somebody's brother, sister, mother, child, aunt, uncle, so on and so forth. We talk about the horrific damage. These bodies that we have in this life are fragile, lots of damage. And it's an ugly thing to see when you're in the first responder space. So I don't want to diminish the traumatic events that first responders are exposed to. In fact, in the emergency responder space, they're exposed to more potentially traumatic events in a single day than many of us experience in a lifetime. But that also doesn't take away from them that growth process, that when we face difficult things, how do we come out of them stronger? And what are we willing to put the work into it to see how we can grow and learn from that experience and then apply it in the future? That's how we grow wisdom, right? And that's how we grow as individuals. And I think we need to shift the language a little bit in the traumatic space that first responders work in. We talk a lot about PTSD. Well, what about talking about post-traumatic growth? That is a thing. There is a science behind it. Yes, there are different trajectories after all those exposures. Just like I said, in that space, you have a choice. And it's not solely the onus of the individual. It has to be that they're in an environment that supports them. They have to feel the self-agency to make those decisions. They have to have access to the resources in order to facilitate where they need to go after those traumatic events. So it is very complex in creating, going back to where I came from, that strategy. It's how we talk about it. It's the programs that are available. It's the leadership that is setting the culture and the standards for the agency. It is empowering the individual to make those choices at the micro level, and it's the environment and the resources surrounding them. So it's actually quite complex if you look at how to build a good wellness program and driving towards that sense of growth so that we retain that purpose and meaning and keep first responders wanting to come do this incredibly noble job.
In your travels across the country and even around the world and your interaction with public safety, what have you seen that gets you excited? What have you seen that really like seems to be working for a public safety agency?
Well, that's a great question because public safety agencies are very different, right? In their needs and the type of what the work is being done by those individuals, whether they're small, medium, large, are they rural, are they urban? And so, you know, the needs of LAPD that has a very robust wellness program and has, in fact, resourced their wellness program since the early 1970s is very different from a small town in Montana as you were driving, you know, biking through this past summer. I think that the things, hallmarks of success, if you will, are agencies that understand the needs of their people, that they recognize where their people are willing to start engaging in their health and wellness. So a lot of times we want to come in very heavy at the top, you know, suicide's our problem. We're going to implement suicide prevention without really understanding the context of the environment and the needs of that specific agency, because it could very well be that agency isn't suffering from PTSD, depression, and anxiety, but they have childcare issues or they have financial issues, and those are the stressors. So it takes the best wellness programs, whether we're talking public safety or external to public safety, first take the time to deeply understand the needs of the population that they're serving. So those agencies need to do a needs assessment. Happy to talk about the science about that in detail later if people want to follow up with me. But step one, understand your people before building your program. Step two is analyzing what are those priorities. You may have a list of 20 priorities, and most agencies don't have the resources to support it. So you're going to have to narrow the aperture. Where are we going to get the most bang for our buck? And where are we going to get the most engagement from our people? And those other priorities will come as your program builds out, but really focusing on where can you springboard this culture into your agency are successful steps. There's traditional programs that are across the board generally very successful if they're run well and the individuals are taught, like peer support programs. Therapy dog programs have been very successful in helping responders to open up post-critical incident. We also see a lot of success with the post-traumatic growth program that Boulder Crest implements in conjunction with FirstNet. So there's lots of programs out there that are potentially transformative to the culture of those different agencies across the nation.
What if someone says, well, we're a small agency. We just don't have the budget for this kind of thing. I mean, that's been the number one thing for a lot of people is like, you know, where does the money come from to take care of this?
Well, I can tell you quite honestly that all the programs that we support are delivered free to the agencies in the different regions that go in. That's one of the reasons we got in that space. It's one of the reasons why I did not build out my own program with the FirstNet Health and Wellness program in terms of a traditional wellness training, because there were many nonprofits out there that needed support. They were evidence-based. They had strong results behind them, whether we're talking First Help, Boulder Crest Foundation, All Clear Foundation, and some of the O2X Human Performance. That's another one that we work with. All of those programs were able to demonstrate their evidence-based results to me. And so I would much rather work with those nonprofits and programs than recreate the wheel and really create a bottleneck, especially since we are a large organization. And so what I would tell those small agencies is there are nonprofits out there to help you. Write out the standards of what your people want from a wellness program and don't budge on them when you go and vet that program to deliver to you. I'd also say there are so many community organizations, from the 100 Club to Lions Clubs to local Rotary Clubs, who are willing to help fund these things if you put together a good business case for them. And so that is another area that sometimes you need to work with your community. Sometimes your community public health program will have those resources from the local city council to support you. It's not always we have to do it inside our little, inside our little bubble. The best programs are ones that collaborate with all the resources that are around them, or reach out to see what's available from a funding perspective and make sure it matches what their people need, and then implement that.
That's one thing I really like about what Todd Jerry's doing at Garland PD. And he talks about on the first episode of this podcast, he talks about the buffet of options that they offer. You know, he's reached out to all these local organizations within their geographic region and said, hey, how can you support us? How can we have our officers, our staff be supported by these organizations? And you can pick and choose. You may like, you may be all into horses and equine therapy is your thing, but you may not like this other thing that they do. So they can pick and choose.
That is exactly a model that I would support, especially for an agency that's struggling, putting it on paper what's available for your responders and then providing them and encouraging them to take advantage of what's available.
And sometimes it's also reaching across the county or across the city to another agency that maybe has more resources and say, hey, can we partner with you?
Yes. And not only that, is some of the things that we're seeing in the results from the programs that are cross-disciplinary, they improve the community relationships when dispatch, EMS, fire, and police are all coming to the wellness programming together, and they start to see where they have similarities in their own personal struggles and how they can help each other out, and lessons learned cross-agency. So that's an incredibly valuable tool at the hands of many leaders.
Is there anything that frustrates you with the first responder wellness community that you say, I just wish they would do this or do that or not do this or that?
I'm actually it's going to sound like I'm coming up with a really PC response, but the answer is no, they don't frustrate me. But I've also been working in this space for a very long time, and I understand that this is a process, right? We're building momentum towards a culture of wellness. And so I have the patience to recognize that that takes time. I think, and so frustration is not the word that I would use. I would use, how do we need to improve our process? What's the quality improvement that we need as a nation to work together towards driving this? And I think that that's been the space that FirstNet has specifically been working in with the coalition. what are the gaps and how do we, the pain points right now, for example, are how do we communicate those best practices from the national level, the work the First Net Health and Wellness Coalition has been doing, all the way down to the local and state level so that they get the goodness of the work that's been going on for the last 3 years. I would say that is one of my big goals for 2024, is really enhancing that communication and supporting those associations with the evidence and the information and the outcomes that we have been learning from what we've been doing the last 3 years so that they can help their constituents better. So again, frustration is not the word that I would use, but rather there's things that we can always work upon to improve this. And that's where I'm focusing my efforts.
And how have you seen the conversation perhaps get better or having more conversations about this subject within public safety in the past number of years?
Oh, that's been transformative. I mean, when we first set up the Health and Wellness Coalition, it was very quiet on the line. People came to the table. They were very interested in what was being proposed, that we work together across industry, community, first responder, and localized effort. Like, how do we work together, the academic experts in this field? How do we collaborate to advance this at a national level? So they were very interested, but they were very quiet. And I remember coming out of one of the first couple of meetings going like, I'm not sure I'm succeeding in this job. I was very hard on myself. I have done coalition work for 20 years, and I started questioning my own process. But I also know from that experience, the virtue of wisdom is to keep focused on the process, keep focused on the strategy, and see what happens. And over the past 3 years, the wealth of leadership that these associations are bringing to this issue of first responder wellness, how they are talking, how they're identifying points of collaboration, where they definitely see the top issues, right? So for example, we have 7 health risk priorities for the coalition, and they're post-traumatic stress, depression and self-harm, physical fitness, stress management, responder resiliency, and family member and leadership engagement. So that's how we framed the problem. We really spent a good year understanding what are the health risk factors that are the top concerns from an individual standpoint, as well as a macro level agency and therefore nation standpoint. And then as that conversation grew and the leadership became more and more engaged, and they have, this last year, we have spent the time focusing on, well, if those are our priorities, what do we need to do about them as a nation? And I'm happy to provide this to you for your show notes. We just, on the 5th of September, published the First Net Health and Wellness Coalition Lessons Learned and Outcomes to Date white paper. It is a white paper called Helping the Helpers that outlines 5 national level recommendations that need to occur in this space that all of those 8 associations have rallied behind. We have over 20 endorsements from those associations. We have 40 executives in the first responder space that have been working with the coalition that have personally endorsed this work. And those 5 recommendations are: how do we engage leaders? We talked about that earlier in the show, right? What training do leaders need to do to lean in to leading health and wellness at their agency level? The second recommendation is that health and wellness needs to be integrated into the training and education lifecycle of all responders nationwide. That means as you progress throughout your career, how are we having those wellness touch points throughout? Because it changes, right? The health and wellness needs of 20-year-old Anna Corey is not the same health and wellness needs as 40-year-old Anna Corey or 50-year-old Anna Corey as I get older. So those are things that need to be incorporated in. And concurrently with that, we need to establish the standards for that. What do those minimum standards look like for health and wellness programs across the nation? The 4th recommendation is resource allocation. Grants are great, right? They are filling a very needed space in the first responder world to support implementation of health and wellness programs, but we need to go beyond that. Grants are not a sustainability strategy, mm-hmm. right? We need for our communities to understand that they must resource the health and wellness of their emergency responders at their local level. Don't ask them to choose between their fire truck or cruiser and their responders' health and wellness needs. It needs to be a part of how it's budgeted mm-hmm. into every agency. And then finally, I already mentioned it and touched on it before, that communication. How do we do better as a nation communicating to our legislators, communicating to each other, communicating to our states and the individuals why health and wellness is so important in the first responder world?
You know, one of the things that we're trying to do with our film is to bring to the table, to our screenings, local officials, city leaders, you know, community leaders, and to help them better understand the needs of first responders so that they can go back and say, hey, we need to put that line item in the budget for health and wellness for agency mm-hmm. XY. And you know, I've seen that where it's been very successful. Neil Gang in Pinole, California has that with his officers. He has a line item in the budget where this is there every year they provide yep. for their officers. And so many communities don't do that. And I kind of make the analogy of if you buy a Mercedes and you spend $100,000 on that Mercedes, you're going to do everything you possibly can to maintain that thing so it keeps on running, right? Because mm-hmm. an engine's really expensive to replace. If you don't do that, you're going to be replacing an engine. It's the same thing with, you know, investing hundreds of thousands of dollars into one individual. It's less expensive to maintain than it is to repair.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a fantastic analogy. And I would also say that the other thing that our communities and municipalities and local city councils need to understand, they need to understand this so very much, so very thoroughly. And this is something I'm passionate about. Our community resilience, our community health rests on the backbone of our first responders and their capacity to take care of public safety. If we are not taking care of that backbone, our communities will crumble.
Absolutely.
This is an inherently symbiotic relationship and something that we must do. I look at it just as important as the infrastructure of roads and national defense and all the things that we take for granted. We have got to take care of the first responders that are the individuals as human beings that they are.
Absolutely. And if you don't, you're going to have stories that end up on the evening news.
Yes.
You know, and unfortunately, we've seen that play out over and over again across our country in the recent years. And I think some of those stories, maybe not all of them, but some of them could have had a different ending if those responders would have been in a healthy place.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
So what's one thing that an individual can do if they're in a place and they're noticing that, hey, I'm struggling, maybe I'm drinking too much, maybe I'm doing, you know, I'm spending too much time at the casino or doing some other things that are destructive. What's one thing an individual can do to start down that path of taking care of themselves personally?
Reach out and ask for help. Responders have a tendency to think they're alone in their struggle. They have a tendency to think that they're the ones who bring help, therefore they are not the ones who need help. But that's not true. Before you are a first responder, you're a human being, and human beings need help. We do things as community. We're social organisms, even whether we're introverted or extroverted, and our degree of connection or what we need, we all need some sort of connection. And asking for help, there is no shame in that. I ask for help on a daily basis, and I'm an expert in this field. We have health and wellness checks across our entire peer support team, just check-ins. They call in and check on me as much as I call in and check on them. It is an acknowledgement of the culture that we wanted to start within my portfolio that it's okay to reach out for help. And that starts with me too. I've reached out for them and said, hey, I need somebody to listen to me. Safe space. it's quiet here. You know, it stays here, and it builds trust and it builds connection. So sometimes when we reach out, when we need help with somebody we trust, we're going to build that connection. And what happens in a space of connection is caring. And that's how we move ourselves forward in our wellness journey, because we have somebody who cares about our future, and we owe that to each other as the individual reaching out for help, and the other person needs to be ready to listen. Mm-hmm. I charge everyone with what I tell AT&T. We say that we're going to be there. It's our tagline. It's one of our value statements. We will be there for each other, our communities, our customers. Well, that applies to everyone. Everyone needs to be there for each other. And that first step for the individual struggling, don't be afraid to reach help. It's worth it. And for the person that's doing the receiving of that reaching out, be there for that individual.
You know, that's one thing I learned in my coast to coast bike ride is just to be present.
Yes,
exactly. And to be there. And sometimes I think we get so busy with doing the thing that we forget to be present. That we forget to just be there in the moment. And that was the beauty about riding a bicycle. I had lots of time to be there in the moment. And so yes. I learned that even now when someone is talking to me, to really be present. How many times have we been in a conversation, and I don't even have my phone here, I'm going to pick it up, but how many times have we been in a conversation with someone and we've had our phone in our hand and we're glancing at it, so we're not present?
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think that's part of a downfall for technology is that it has connected us in many great ways, mm-hmm. but it has also disconnected us in too many, you know, terrible ways. And if we can just learn to, in that conversation, to listen, but really to listen and be present, I think that will make a huge difference for all of us.
Absolutely. Connecting drives us towards greater possibility and inspires us to do more. So reaching out and connecting is one of those things that we definitely support as an organization.
So I want to ask you a personal question, if I may. What do you do to take care of yourself and your mental health?
Believe it or not, I am very much into weightlifting, which I know is a little unusual, but I started out in powerlifting when my husband was deployed. I think I must have been very angry and just need to pick up big things and drop them hard. I don't do quite that intensive. Mostly I focus on functional fitness, but I believe very strongly in lifting heavy things. One, my father, before he passed away, was severely disabled, and I always wanted to be strong enough to be able to pick him up off of the ground. That was just something that I felt was very, very important. And I know the health benefits, especially as we age, keeping strong bones, strong muscles. I'm an avid walker. Used to be a runner, but I actually prefer the contemplativeness. I do a lot of walking meditation when I walk. Love to hike, love to sail, love to travel. And I love to spend time with my family. So I try and prioritize, you know, when I look at the three most important things in my life, are God, my family, and my health. And so I tend to prioritize those top three things as a way of managing my personal health in light of the stressors of the work that I do.
That's awesome. And final question. Well, one thing I want to ask you first is there anything else you want to discuss related to the culture of wellness? Anything else that's on, you know, front of mind for you?
Well, culture of wellness starts with you. Like all the things I think have had themes that we've talked about today is that ability, the self-efficacy to choose, you know, the leadership choices that are there, the individual choices, the agency, the community choices that are there. Everybody has an opportunity to lead. We talk a lot about wellness. Well, you know what? If we talk about it, then we need to do something about it. That's how the culture truly shifts, is when we all start doing something and being what we want wellness to be like in whatever group or situation or agency that we're in. I think that, you know, I've written extensively in this space in various articles and thought leadership pieces, but my biggest call to action for your audience is to read the white paper. understand how those recommendations and how you can be a champion of those health and wellness needs of first responders is in that white paper. And we have a toolkit for reaching out to our state and local representatives so that we can begin, again, building that groundswell of advocacy for this very important infrastructure that all of our communities rely on.
That's awesome. And final question, I promise. Are you doing anything fun in the next month?
Oh, well, I am a huge football fan. So I am going to Clemson football, as even though it might not be our best season this year, I still am all in on being a Clemson Tiger, and we go to the football game. So I'll be going with my family on Saturday to a football game.
I'm
looking forward to that. FAU, I think.
Okay.
Florida Atlantic. Yeah. I think that that's it. I used to know the schedule like the back of my hand, and details and travel. I haven't been as good at keeping up with it, but I love football. My husband and I enjoy it together. So that's what we do.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for being on the program today. I really appreciate your insight. I appreciate your leadership and what you guys are doing there at AT&T in the first responder space. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Conrad. This was an incredible conversation. The time flew by. I loved being here with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Dr. Corey, for your leadership and insights. And thanks to you for listening to the show. I really appreciate it. Please leave a review and give it 5 stars if you think it's worth it. And don't forget to subscribe to the show. That way you'll always get the notifications of when we have a new episode launched. Also, just a reminder that you can see the video of this content on our Patreon channel. It's the only place where you can see the video. I'll leave a link in the show notes where you can access that information. We want others to discover this content and benefit from it as well, so please share. And remember, you are not alone. And if you need someone to talk to and you don't know where to turn, dial 988 for help. There are people standing by ready to listen. Until next time, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something good in the world.